Hey, I'm sure that many of you were tempted to stay home and maybe sit out on the deck today instead of being here, but you're here, and so God bless you all. You know, as Pastor Paul said, for the last several weeks we've been in this Game Changers series, and we've looked at the lives of some game changers, and we've looked at the characteristics of some game changers. Well, today we'll be talking about how game changers make a difference. We'll be looking at the lives of some people that have made a difference, and talking about how you can make a difference, how you can be a game changer. And what a fitting day to do just that, Memorial Day weekend. You know, Memorial Day is supposed to be about a time of remembering. It was originally intended to be a time where we honored those who had lost their lives in the military service of our country. And but over time, it's become a time where we not only pay tribute to those who have lost their lives, but also to just to honor all those who've served in the military. Just a chance to say thank you for being willing to put it on the line for us. And so, you know, let's do that right now. Is there anybody here that's served in the military? If you have, if you wouldn't mind, just kind of stand up so that we can say thank you. All right. Thank you all. Thank you. For many, Memorial Day is a time where we remember all of the loved ones that we've lost over time. And for our family, in our house, it's a time where we kind of share the memories of those who aren't with us any longer with the rest of the family. And guys, since you've kind of become like my family, I thought I would share with you my memories of a couple of people that greatly impacted my life. In fact, one of them impacted it so much so that I named my daughter, my one and only daughter, after her, my grandma Cora Lott. My grandparents, Ray and Cora, they were simple dirt farmers from Kansas that actually lost their farm in the Great Depression. And in spite of being two of the hardest working people that I've ever known, they loved to tell stories, and I remember how Grandpa would tell stories about during the Great Depression how we worked for 50 cents a day. The work day was from sunup to sundown, and he had to provide his own team of horses combining wheat. The days were long, and the work was hard, but jobs were scarce, and so he was just glad to have one. They didn't have much of anything, and so everything found a use. My grandma would tell about how flour used to come in these cloth sacks, and how she would use those cloth sacks to make clothes for the kids. My grandparents raised five children in a two-bedroom house, and during part of that time, her parents, my great-grandparents, lived with them. They never really had much of anything, and it seemed like everything that they had was either shared, loaned out, or simply given away. And at the end of their lives, they really left nothing of any real monetary value. My grandparents were married for over 60 years, and at the end of their lives, they didn't have much more than they started with, which was pretty much nothing. In fact, when they died and their belongings were divided up, pretty much everybody in the family got back the things that they had given them, because my grandparents never really bought anything for themselves. So my inheritance was actually two end tables and a coffee table that I made for them when I was in college, and a rickety old couch that I gave to them several years before when I upgraded to something a little bit nicer. My grandparents were far from successful by today's standards, yet they were more than significant. They always had time to sit and talk, and when you were with them, you always felt like you were the most important person in the world. Their tiny house was always filled with family and friends because it was always open. Everyone was always welcome. They never locked their doors. And so because of that, a lot of wayward young men and women, I number myself among them, would show up at Grandpa and Grandma's for a place to stay, a place to sleep, something to eat. My dad said it like this. He said, you know, my folks were always a soft place to land when life got hard. And that's something I've tried to do with my kids, be a soft, safe place to land when life gets hard. You know, and I can only remember one thing that my grandfather ever, the only one request that he ever made of the many guests that would come and go from his place all the time. And he used to say, you know what, just don't leave your beer in the refrigerator because grandma gets into it and it makes her mean. And so, other than that, they loved unconditionally. They asked nothing from anyone. And people would come from all over just to feel significant, just to feel loved. And sometimes there are people that we didn't even really know, almost like strangers. I remember having a conversation with my grandmother one day, and I'm like, Grandma, you know, I think people are using you. And she looked at me, and she gave me a hug, and she said, Honey, we know they are, but that's why we're here. My grandma got up every morning at 4 a.m. to bake bread. And on Sunday, she made cinnamon rolls. You could always count on Grandma for fresh bread and hot coffee no matter what time you stopped by. But Sunday mornings, those cinnamon rolls, they were the real deal. They were the real draw. And so on Sunday mornings, her house would fill to overflowing with friends and family and the smell of those cinnamon rolls. And everything they did, they communicated the same thing to those who would come. You know what? You matter. You matter. I was very blessed at the end of my grandmother's life as she was dying in the hospital. I got to spend some time talking with my grandfather. You know, he shared a lot of memories. He shared a lot of wisdom, kind of wisdom that you only glean from a long life. And if you don't mind, I share it with a lot of people, the wisdom. I'll just share a little bit with you because I asked him, you know, after 60 years of marriage, I mean, you were with Grandma your whole life. Almost your entire life. I said, do you have any regrets? And you know what? He didn't tell me that he wished they had a bigger house. He didn't tell me he wished they would have gone on that vacation that they'd always talked about. He didn't tell me that they wished they had nicer clothes or a fancier car or more money in the bank. You know, at the end, for 60 years married to the same woman, he said, you know what? I just wish that we had more time. It all went by so fast. His only regret after 60 years of marriage, the same woman, that they didn't have more time together. You know, in James chapter 4, verse 14, it says, what is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a while and then vanishes. Because one thing is for certain. I don't care where you're at in your life or how much time you think that you have left. One thing is for sure, it's going to go by faster than you can possibly imagine. So be wise in how you invest your time. And you'll need to decide at some point, do you want to be successful or do you want to be significant? Because there is a difference. The difference is, okay, being successful is all about me. And being significant is all about others. In Matthew chapter 6, beginning verse 19, Jesus says, do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Okay, so let me just ask you, do you know that there's only one thing that we get to take with us into heaven? Do you know what that is? Other people. That's it. That's all that goes with us. I think sometimes we get so caught up in being successful that we miss out on our opportunities to really be significant. We wear ourselves out chasing after what the world would call success. We're so overwhelmed and consumed with the things that don't last that we miss out on our opportunities to really make a difference. Or sometimes we look around and we think to ourselves, wow, I mean, there's so much wrong in this world and I'm just one person, you know. How much of a difference can I really make? Well, I'm going to tell you a story. And this story's been around for a while, and so if you've heard it before, that's okay. It's worth hearing again. It goes something like this. Young man's walking along the beach, and he sees literally thousands and thousands of starfish that have been washed up by the storm the night before. And as he walks a little bit farther, he sees this old man, and the old man is picking up starfish and throwing them back into the ocean. As he gets to the old man, the young man says, "Old man, why are you throwing those starfish back in the ocean?" The old man says, why, the sun's coming up and the tide's going out. If I don't throw them back, they're going to die. The young man says, if you looked around, there's miles and miles of beaches. There's thousands and thousands of starfish all along the beach. You can't possibly save even a tenth of them. In fact, even if you were to be here all day, you can't hardly make any kind of a difference at all. The old man bent down. He picked up a starfish. He looked at it, threw it in the ocean, looked at the young man. He said, you know what? I made a difference for that one. Okay, and because that's the way that you make a difference. It literally happens one life at a time. That's how you make a difference. You know, as I was doing research for this message, I actually did a Google search, list of the most influential people of all time. And every list, same man, appears number one. You want to guess who that is? Jesus, right? Absolutely. For sure. And then after Jesus, typically there was some of these other religious guys. Usually Muhammad was in that number two slot. And then a whole vast array of different scientists and philosophers and world leaders, depending on whose list that you look at. But there's, interestingly enough, there was one Bible figure who consistently made the top 10. You want to guess who that was? I mean, after Jesus, of course. The Apostle Paul consistently makes that top 10. Now, we've talked about Paul before. He was a guy who was on his way literally to power, prestige, and great wealth. By the time he was 30, he would have been what many considered in his day to be a very successful man. And then he has this encounter with Jesus on the road to Damascus, right? And his encounter with Jesus changes his life. And his path changes from becoming one of the most successful men of his time to becoming one of the most influential men of all time. He becomes apostle to the Gentiles. Now, Paul planted 14 churches that are mentioned in the Bible. There's probably another six or eight that he planted that aren't mentioned. He becomes a major contributor to the world's number one best-selling book of all time, the Bible, right? Over 6 billion copies sold to date. Paul writes 14 books, if you want to include Hebrews, found in the Bible. And his writings make up nearly two-thirds of the New Testament. And it's one of those books, actually the last book he ever writes that I want to spend some time in today. Okay? He writes this last book to a young man that he's been mentoring. His final words of advice to a young man who would take up the ministry where Paul leaves off. Okay? That young man, Timothy, and this is Paul's second letter and final letter to Timothy. Now, to give you a little background without getting into the entire story, excuse me, Paul spent the last 10 years of his ministry and his life in and out of Roman prison, okay? His initial charge was inciting a riot back in Jerusalem, okay? Well, it wasn't actually Paul that incited the riot. It was actually the Jews who were trying to kill him for preaching the gospel of Christ, right? Now, back when he was a very successful man, he had purchased his Roman citizenship. And so as a Roman citizen, he's able to exercise his right to have a trial back in Rome, okay? And because the Jews are a lot bigger threat than the Romans are, he exercises that right. He's transported back to Rome. Now, when he gets to Rome, they deem that he's really not that big of a threat, and so they just put him under house arrest. He's guarded, but he has a lot of freedom to still preach and teach, and he meets with some of the pastors of the churches that he has planted and does a lot of correspondence back and forth with them. In fact, eventually, Paul is acquitted and released, but not for long. Under Nero, a new wave of Christian persecution would break out, and he would be quickly rearrested, and Nero was going to take it to a new level. And so this time, he's not under house arrest. This time he's actually in chains and in the dungeon. And in fact, he finds himself pretty much abandoned. Nearly everyone that's close to him, for fear of their own lives, deserts him. we actually read at the end of 2 Timothy, chapter 4, verse 16, he says, "At my first defense, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me." See, much like Jesus, at the end of his life, Paul finds himself pretty much all alone, but not really alone. If we read the next verse in verse 17, he says, "But the Lord stood with me and gave me strength, all alone and yet never alone, because the Lord is with him." But by this point, Paul recognizes that he's at the end of his life. He's not going to get away this time. His execution is imminent. And we read actually in verse 6, 2 Timothy 4, it says, "As for me, my life has already been poured out as an offering to God. The time of my death is near. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have remained faithful." So as Paul nears the finish line, as he's at the end of his fight, he writes these last words of wisdom and encouragement to a young man who's become like a son to him. In fact, several times in his letters, he refers to Timothy as my son. Now, I've always found and been intrigued by the last words of a man. And this is the last letter that Paul ever writes. Okay? And as he writes this letter to Timothy, he shares with Timothy the wisdom on how to live a life of real significance, how to really make a difference. We read in 2 Timothy, now chapter 2, it says, "And what you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men." What he tells Timothy is, if you want to make a difference, invest in people. Invest in people. Paul recognizes that the only things that really survive us are the ones that we've passed on to others. Jesus modeled this for us all. Jesus' time on earth was limited, and he invested the majority of his time not in teaching the masses, which he did, not in feeding the masses, which he did that as well, not in healing the masses or performing great miracles, although he certainly did those also. Okay, but Jesus invested the most of his time and the men who would carry on the work after he was gone. You want to be significant, you want to make a difference, you invest in people. Okay, now Paul never married, and he never had children, yet he still knew and understood the significance of family, importance of family. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, we read, "But if anyone does not provide for his own relatives, and especially for members of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than the unbeliever." Paul says, invest in people, but begin at home. Now, guys, let me just tell you, discipling your own family can be a bit of a challenge. You'll never receive the same affirmation and the same praise that you get from friends, or even strangers for that matter. Very often you'll feel taken for granted, and often you'll meet with a great deal of resistance. Nonetheless, the ministry that we do at home is absolutely the most important ministry that we have. In fact, where else in Scripture do you read that if you're not doing this, you're worse than the unbeliever? I guess that can't be. So let me just tell you, begin at home. Invest in your spouse. Now, I talk to a lot of people, and I ask them sometimes, I say, well, you know what, after your relationship with God, what's the most important relationship in your life? Now, if they're married, they will almost always answer correctly, why, my relationship with my spouse, of course. However, in terms of the amount of time and energy, it seems that most important relationship tends to take a back seat to almost every other pursuit. And so I invite people, take a look at that most important relationship. What are you feeding it? Is that most important relationship, is that getting your first and your best, or does it get the leftovers, the scraps, after everything else is finished? Invest in your spouse. Then disciple your kids. And people, it's great that you bring your kids with you to church on Sunday morning. I mean, that's a great thing. And if you bring them here on Thursday nights for youth group, that's a great thing too. But if you really want to make disciples, if you really want to make your kids into followers of Christ, it takes a little bit more than just that. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 18, it says, "So commit yourself wholeheartedly to these words of mine. Teach them to your children. Talk about them when you're at home and when you're on the road, when you're going to bed and when you're getting up." Literally what God says is, teach your children about me. Talk about me all the time. Bring me up in everything that you do. So let me just ask you, if you have kids, have you talked with your kids about what it means to be a Christian family? Have you talked to them about how that makes you different from other families? And what that looks like lived out? Have you discussed your family values? Because if you haven't, I'd like you to consider doing that sometime soon. Have that discussion with your kids. A number of years ago, I did that with my family. My only regret is that I didn't do it sooner, that I didn't do it when my boys were still young. And I tell you, after weeks and weeks of some really, really cool discussions around the dinner table, this is what we came up with. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that ours are perfect. This is what yours should look like. However, these are what we came up with. This is what we agreed to, and this is what seems to work for us. Thank you. And my whole family knows this by memory. I quizzed Cora on it this morning. She certainly knew it. You better. But for us, for the Lot family puts God first. The Lot family loves one another. The Lot family tells the truth. The Lot family works hard. And the Lot family has a good attitude. Now, I could probably preach a message on each one of those. I could probably spend a great deal of time explaining to you what that looks like lived out for our family, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to suggest that you do that at home, with your family, with your kids. And let me just tell you, if you're willing to do that, you open yourself up to some really just amazing conversations. And trust me with that. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Now you say, "Well, Pastor Rod, that's all well and good for the married with children crowd. What about us singles? What about us empty nesters?" Well, for everyone, guys, I say, disciple someone. In Paul's letter to another young man that he was mentoring, he gives this advice to Titus. We read in Titus chapter 2, beginning with verse 4, he says, "These older women must train the younger women, and in the same way encourage the young men to live wisely, and you yourself must model it for them." Be an example to them. Because we should all be in some kind of a mentoring relationship. If you're older, you should be mentoring someone that's younger. And if you're newer in the faith, you should be in a relationship with someone else that's further along so that they can mentor you. And did you notice that last part? It must be an example. Guys, because teaching is more than just talking. And I've heard it said, and I found it to be absolutely true. Okay? Kids will never fail to ignore what they hear you say, and yet they will never fail to model what they see you do. So let me just ask you, what are we teaching our kids by the way we live, by the way we act? In Exodus chapter 20, verse 5, it says, "I lay the sins of the parents upon their children, and the entire family is affected, even children in the third and fourth generations." And what this is really about is it's about the legacy that we leave. See, what we teach our children by the way that we live, by our actions, is the real legacy that we leave to them. These are those generational curses, right, that are passed on, or generational blessings from parent to child to child's child, from generation to generation. So, okay, so what are we teaching our children when we disrespect one another? Right? You teach them to be disrespectful. What are we teaching our children when we don't have any time for them, when everything else is more important than they are? And what are we teaching our children when we live just for ourselves and our own selfish desires? Okay, so if we're going to talk the talk, especially at home, we need to walk the walk. In the last three letters that Paul writes to his church plants, letters that he writes from prison, letters that he writes at the end of his life, he tells all three the same basic thing. To the church in Ephesus, he writes, "I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called." To the church in Philippi, he says, "Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ." And to the Colossians, he writes, "Walk in a manner worthy of the Lord." And each one, same thing. He emphasizes the same thing. It's about the witness of our walk. And guys, if you're going to be a significant influence, if you're going to impact the world in which you live, if we're going to win people for Christ, we need to walk worthy. So let me ask you, are you storing up treasures in heaven? Are you investing in people? Are you investing your time in the things that really last, the things that really matter, in your spouse, in your kids? Are you investing the work that God's doing? Are you investing in making an eternal difference? And guys, I'm going to stop for just a second. Actually, there's a video that I'd like you to watch. It's a little bit longer, but I think it's worthwhile. So I'm going to let you watch this, and I'm going to come back up and finish up.
Dreamed I went to heaven, you were there with me. We walked upon the streets of gold, beside the crystal sea. We heard the angels singing, and someone called your name. We turned and saw this young man, and he was smiling as he came. And he said, "Friend, you may not know me now." And then he said, "But wait. You used to teach my Sunday school when I was only 8. And every week you would say a prayer before the class would start. And one day when you said that prayer, I asked Jesus in my heart. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am a life that was changed. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am so glad you gave." Then another man stood before you and said, "Remember the time a missionary came to your church and his pictures made you cry. You didn't have much money, but you gave it anyway. Jesus took the gift he gave, and that's why I'm here today. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am a life that was changed. One by one they came, far as the eye could see. Each life somehow touched by your generosity. Little things that you had done, sacrifices made, unnoticed on the earth, in heaven now proclaimed. And I know up in heaven you're not supposed to cry, but I am almost sure there were tears in your eyes as Jesus took your hand and you stood before the Lord. He said, my child, look around you, for great is your reward. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am a life that was changed. Thank you for giving to the Lord. I am so glad you came. Thank you for giving to the Lord.
Let me just tell you, my original intent was to invite people up here that had contributed to the success of Lamplighter over the years, and particularly some of those that invested themselves in making all this happen. But I was afraid we wouldn't have room for everybody up here on the stage, and we wouldn't have anybody left out there to thank them. And so I just thank all of you guys. Certainly this place is a beautiful place, but it's not coming with us to heaven. Okay, but look around. This is the reward. Okay, it's the people that come in here. It's the lives that you touch, either here or someplace else. And guys, I just want to thank you all for the difference that you make. You guys are game changers. You're difference makers. So thank you. And that's for you, by the way. So let me just pray, and then we'll be on about this beautiful Memorial Day weekend. Father God, we are so thankful, Lord, that we can get together like this. This is a huge blessing over all these people that have come here today. Help them to be mindful of the things, the opportunities that they have to really be make a difference. Help them to invest in people, not so much in things that don't last. And Lord, we just look forward to the day where we can all be in heaven, Lord, and we can just look around and recognize the great reward that we have for all the people that we're able to bring with us. Just continue to bless this place and all those that come in here, Lord, that your will, work and your will may be done. And it's through these people that it happens. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you all. Have a great day.